101.9 FM. Fresh news, smart talk, all day.
The views and opinions of the hosts and guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect the position of the management and staff of Guardian Networks.
Good yawning this morning and welcome back to Guardian Radio 96.9 FM, your station for fresh news, smart talk all day. It is Tuesday, the 6th of December, 2022, and you are on the clock with Erin Green on this World News Tuesday with Mr. Mark Palmer and unfortunately missing Ms. Gail Hanna. Good morning, Mr. Palmer.
Morning, Erin. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. Let me see.
What happened? You look a little hungry.
I'm going to tell you how good we all are. I'm going to go eat the whole world on the radio station this morning.
Okay.
My feelings, the whole world got up reasonable time, you know, thought that 30 minutes would be, 40 minutes would be good time to get breakfast, get to the station. No, sir. No, sir.
Don't tell me you got caught in traffic.
No.
No.
I mean, a sort of traffic.
Yeah.
Kind of traffic where the breakfast lines are just moving very, very slowly. I stopped two establishments. So that's how quickly I was moving.
So where do you go for your breakfast?
Well, I typically go to a deli. I'm not going to name them.
Okay.
They're moving a little slow this morning. I like them. They're moving a little slow this morning. Go to a deli. They were backed up, moving very slowly. Mm-hmm. Both staff and customers. I guess it's that sort of morning. It's very cold. Went to a foreign food establishment. I can no longer call it fast food. I think it should be against the law to call them fast food establishments.
Dead food.
I mean, that's another way, but I call them foreign, right? Like FF, foreign food establishments.
Well, you know, there's a little place down the bottom of Frederick Street North where they do patties. But I went to get a patty. There was like 30 people. I couldn't even get my patty.
Where do you park?
You park right outside.
On the sidewalk?
No, where the jitneys park, because you're only going to be there for like a couple seconds, right?
See, I can't go there neither, Mark. I can't go. So there's a place that I used to go that is relatively quick, but they don't discourage their customers from blocking the sidewalk, from parking in the road, parking on the sidewalk, making it difficult for pedestrians to move through. And it's in a zone where a large number of disabled or mobility challenged people have motorized scooters, right? Gotcha. So it's in an area where you see a lot of sort of self-sufficiency and agency amongst the disabled community moving through on the sidewalks that are available. But I cannot patronize it because it refuses to stop its customers from blocking the roadway, blocking the parking lot, blocking the sidewalk. In fact, customers will pull up and park their exhaust fume cars right in front of the business where people are standing.
That's not good.
So I can't patronize it, right? Mm-hmm. So I was having great difficulty. In fact, I was so hot, I was getting ready to call establishments names because I think the level of service requires public acknowledgement. So perhaps the owners can understand their obligation to fix it. Maybe the owners would understand that the onus is on them and not the poorly trained, poorly equipped staff that they leave to face the public every day. The scene that I ran upon this morning, though, was extraordinary. I'm prepared, but I'm not prepared.
So maybe they started late. You think that would, what happened?
I could be honest, it's like they were, half of the staff was in a meeting in the building.
Oh, okay.
It did. They were just having a horrible morning this morning. So after waiting about 8 minutes online, finally get to the cashier, to watch the cashier walk away from me. Don't say nothing. Walk in the back and just disappear. I pack up my Georgie bundle, and I prepare to eat my feelings for the morning.
Actions have consequences. Now we have Aaron on the radio.
Yes. Fortunately, the food gods have smiled upon us. Mm-hmm. And Mr. Mark Palmer has blessed us this morning with a big bowl of star fruit and two giant plantain. I can't never get hungry. If y'all looking, if y'all are on the live feed on the Guardian Radio app right now, you could see the two biggest plantain I've seen grown locally in a long time.
That's my wife say, get up. She said, that one's ripe. Get your machete and boom, yes, you have to go and cut that right down.
Yes, because you're just tempting people. You're tempting the thieves. You're tempting the raccoons. You're tempting the rats. Like, all of these animals are like, buddy, I just...
But I don't have rats in my yard because I've got Shirley the boa.
We get a pet snake, or like a...
I only seen Shirley like twice in 4 years, but she is impressed. I think it's a she.
Yeah.
Impressed. She's about 10 foot long.
Uh-huh.
About, I would say, about 6 inches in diameter.
Yeah.
At the biggest part. And she goes on the top of the wall, so the dogs can't get her. Very smart. I mean, it must be a pretty old snake, but yeah. I have no rats.
Awesome. That is great.
Yeah.
That is great. Anyway.
I don't know where she goes. I saw her sort of sneaking off down side of one person's house, and then off she goes. Boom.
Yeah. Do you live in a coppice area, like a
trees. We have a lot of bush trees, and I have two neighbors that, one neighbor that doesn't live there anymore.
Yeah.
And so that yard is completely, must be full of snakes. And then the other neighbor who passed away recently, but they have now have somebody living there, but yeah.
Yeah.
Big, two big yards.
To roam in and chill in. That's great.
Yeah.
I mean, an important part of the ecosystem.
Definitely.
Absolutely. And despite a small scare this weekend, there was images floating around purporting to have been taken in New Providence, right? Of an eastern or western rattlesnake. Anyway, Dr. Scott Johnson, the local endemic animal, local animal specialist, indicated that if you saw those images of a swollen hand and a snake in a gray bin, that those images are not from the Bahamas. And I think they're from Tennessee.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
And
we don't have any snakes like that.
Yeah, we don't have any venomous snakes in the Bahamas. So there
Why are people so scared of snakes? You know, I mean, when I caught my first one, because it was in the yard, trying to save it from the dog, my wife and my daughter run inside the house screaming, burst into tears. I had the snake wrapped around my arm. I said, what's wrong?
It's a cultural thing, you know.
Yeah.
It's some
of... They're more scared of you than you of them, really, technically.
First of all, you can't tell me that.
Okay.
But what I do know is that I have to temper my fear, right?
Yeah.
I have to manage my emotions. I have to understand that
it's a cultural one,
right? It can't kill me, right?
Unlikely to bite you either.
Right.
Neither.
And it's my job to protect, if I have pets, small pets and animals, to protect them, right? It's not going to hurt me. It's not going to kill me. But also, like, if you grow up as a little child, you know why a lot of people don't like roach and centipede? Because then they grow up and you sleep and you wake up in the middle of the night and there's roach on you. And you have a traumatic experience as a child, right? And that because...
Well, we all do. When I was living in Eleuthera, sitting on the toilet, right? And this foot-long centipede comes out the wall and crawling around and you can't do nothing, right? You're just sitting there and this thing is walking around. I was like, oh my God. Family Islands, right? You know about that, right?
Yeah. And that happened to me in New Providence. Mm. I woke up one night with a centipede crawling over my foot.
Ooh.
Ooh.
Yeah. Scary, eh?
Horror story.
Mm-hmm.
But we managed to maintain the threat. I mean, I don't want to say on air that we killed the centipede, but I killed the centipede. Mm-hmm. It was a traumatic event.
You know, the blackbirds like them too. Yeah, I see one caught one and slowly eating it on
but
the
listen,
compost.
We shouldn't be killing them, right? Because
put them outside and then they
let them feed the compost, let them do their work in your garden. But apparently centipedes eat little bugs, right? Like they're not the worst thing to have in your house because they're going to eat a lot of pests and help you keep your house clean. But, you know, in that space where we talk about where we develop the fear of these animals, right? Like, of it is cultural, it's collective, it's stories that we tell, it's how we respond to stories about snakes as a collective, and then their personal experiences that we don't necessarily process properly, right? Or we don't process at all. Or sometimes we just push to the back of our brain and forget about until we encounter a similar situation and then have no idea why we are responding irrationally.
I mean, I can understand why, because it's a reptile. It has different eyes, it has different skin and stuff. So I can see why people would be scared, but I think there's also a religious element to it.
Yeah.
Because I had a driver and he went, he saw a snake, got his machete, just chopped it up, right? And I said, why you did that? And, you know, it's like, there's a religious connotation with it.
Yeah.
And so I was kind of shocked about that. But he was very proud of himself.
Because, and I'm sure because he handled his fear, right? Mm-hmm. He was able to take care of the thing that he thought was a threat and he didn't panic. But sometimes handling your fear is allowing that thing to continue doing what it's doing without concern that it's going to bother you. Right?
Well, and you know what the acronym of fear is? False evidence appears real.
Yeah. I think that's good to remember.
Yeah.
Right? The feeling that you're having is real, but sit in it and rationalize it, right? Because it's appearing real. And as soon as you go through those feelings, you realize that they can't defeat you, that they're not going to overwhelm you, and that you're going to be okay. Absolutely.
Mark Twain once said, I had thousands of disasters in my life, and most of them were in my mind.
Yeah.
Great quote.
Yeah. And
I
that's
think a lot
it.
Of people can relate to that, because a lot of stuff we make up in our minds.
A lot of it. Mm-hmm. But coming together and talking about it, sharing your experiences with other people can help to let the false things fall away.
Evidence appear real.
Absolutely. So look here, let me read some texts, and then we've got a guest this morning. We are in 16 Days of Activism, the global campaign, and Alicia Wallace from Equality Bahamas is going to be joining us, and we're going to be talking about this year's campaign, and then we're going to be talking about a couple of the articles in today's paper.
Okay.
One about maternity leave, and one statement from Mr. Michael Pintard, Honorable MP from Grand Bahama. Let's get to these texts. Mark, I got a text here that says, you're speaking too low. Speak up.
Okay.
He on a star fruit high. Look here, and I haven't gotten there yet. He teasing me.
All right.
I got a text here that says, are the Saxons competing this Junkanoo? Buddy, look here. What? First of all, you want us to shut Junkanoo down, eh? I still waiting to figure out how Valley Boys get back into Junkanoo. But if the other Junkanooers let them in, then it must be legit, right? It got to be legit if the other Junkanooers let them back in. So I ain't mad at that. But I can't have Junkanoo without the Saxons competing. And I guess that's what the rest of the Junkanooers said in terms of the Valley Boys and their absence from the Bay Street parades, right? Can't have Bay Street parade without the Valley. Who we could beat up on, Saxons, if the Valley are not there? I agree.
Valley.
Okay, another text. They feel like a fear of snakes is kind of instinctive, too. Okay. All right. We got to explore that. Another text. Aaron, I'm 30 and I'm terrified of snakes, centipedes, and frogs. I ain't got no shame to say I'm scared of them. If you want to rob me, just bring one of those three. That's something, eh? Another text. Great show as usual. No Bahamian in the history of Bahamians is keep a snake as pets. Dear Texter, you have not seen the videos, plural, of the snake charmer. There's a gentleman that walks around with at least two boas. Two.
Where? In Nassau?
Yeah, man. In fact, there's a video of him jumping on a bus with the snakes and everybody else jump off the bus at the same time. Some through the windows, some through the back door. Right? There's videos of him on the beach playing with the snakes.
Oh, I gotta look at that. That sounds great.
Yeah, man. Plenty Bahamians are into reptiles. They keep reptiles as pets.
Okay.
Yeah, man, this ain't
but
no.
A friend of mine in England, he had one big snake, right?
Yeah.
And it got out the the aquarium. They kept it like, you know, one of those tanks. And it disappeared for like 9 months. And they couldn't find it, right? And then one day it came back 9 months later. And they found it back in the... So they just disappeared somewhere. They looked everywhere.
Male or female snake?
I have no idea.
Because, you know...
But I was staying with them. It like freaked me out a little bit.
It should have. I bet you 9 months later...
Found a little mouse hole or something.
Paternity leave was over.
Yeah.
The snake came back to work.
And they were like totally normal about it. Oh, yeah, the name of the snake gone. I said, really? Where? We don't know.
All people wild.
You know, I slept like a pot cake with my eyes open, my ear up, my eyes open, right?
Yeah. Wow. Anyway, okay, let's get to Miss Wallace. Right. Good morning, Miss Wallace. Ah, boy, Miss Wallace. All right, we're going to have to give Alicia a moment. Right. Perhaps she stepped away from her machine. Well, we're in 16 days of... Oh, good morning. How are you? Good morning. Okay. We're having a slight issue. Miss Wallace, you hold on. I think I can hear you, but not loud enough for us to continue the conversation. Don't go anywhere. We're just going to keep talking until we can get the producer to adjust the sound. So we're in 16 days of global activism, right? Mm-hmm. It's a campaign essentially to eradicate violence against women and girls. It starts on the 25th of November, mm-hmm. and it ends on the 10th of December.
Is this the same thing like Zonta, or is that something different?
So Zonta,
is it part of that
a women's rights thing. Organization, gotcha. Will be hosting... It's would also be hosting campaigns and activities.
Yeah.
In fact, the international body mm-hmm. has a UN, they appoint a UN representative. And Zonta has been working with the UN for decades and decades, right? And so, you know, Zonta globally, regionally, and locally has been doing this work for a while. And they also engage. In fact, I think the parliamentarian pinning activity that they held last week was organized partially by Zonta, right? To encourage politicians to focus on women's issues. And so the 25th of November, which was Saturday, last Saturday, marked the International Day for the Elimination of Violence Against Women. The 29th of November was Women Human Rights Defenders Day. The 1st of December was World AIDS Day. The 2nd of December is International Day for the Abolition of Slavery, mm-hmm. which I thought was an interesting day. The 3rd of December, which I think is also an important day, is International Day of Persons with Disabilities. Mm-hmm. Right, and I wanted to focus on that day as well and during this time, and that's going to be coming up soon. But I see, producer, we're trying to get Ms. Wallace in the conversation. Good morning, Ms. Wallace.
Good morning.
There we go. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I am good. Thank you. It is great to have you joining us today. Today is also another special day in the 16 Days of Activism calendar. Can you tell us what today is?
Yes, it is Femicide Awareness Day.
Okay, and what is femicide?
Femicide is the gender-based killing of a woman or a girl. So when women are killed because of their gender or sex or related to gender or sex-based discrimination or violence, that is called femicide. So it's not murder. It is murder, but it's not ordinary homicide.
Right.
We give it this name so that we recognize the systemic issues and the cause of the death.
Okay. So can you give us some examples, right? So I'm a robber. I was robbed with a gun. I buck some people, a mix of people, and I end up shooting at the people who I'm robbing, and I kill a woman in the crowd, right? It's a couple of women, a couple of men. Would that be labeled femicide?
We would not consider that direct femicide, no.
Okay.
So it's about what the motive is or the cause of this violence that results in a death. So we hear a lot of stories about the killings of women and girls that are results of domestic violence. So we hear stories about women who, once they're killed, then we find out that, oh, they were in abusive relationships, that they went to the police multiple times. The family members say they tried to intervene, or maybe they didn't try to intervene, but they knew that the situation was volatile. So we know that there was ongoing violence.
Mm-hmm.
And one of these incidents escalated to the point that the woman was killed. So that is femicide.
All right. So I'm a man. I'm dating a woman. I think my partner is cheating on me. I think she's cheating on me with another woman, right? And so I get angrier and angrier and angrier. And I go out onto the road in my rage. I see some women who I assume are lesbians by the way that they're dressed. And I just fire into the crowd. And I shoot one of them and kill them, right? I don't know them. I just am angry. And I that's the target of my anger. Is that femicide?
That is femicide, yes.
I got you.
Femicide can take various forms. And I think the ones that we're most familiar with, even if we don't call it femicide,
mm-hmm.
are the direct forms. But there are also indirect forms. And this was defined by a former special rapporteur on violence against women, Rashida Manju. And she talked about the difference between direct and indirect, and that indirect is, it can often be the result of a failure, some sort of neglect, a failure of a system. So for example, a woman dying because she was not able to access an abortion. You know, there's a pregnancy that needs to be terminated for reasons of her health, but it's against the law, or for some reason, even if it is legally allowed, it's somehow not accessible because she cannot find an institution or a medical professional to perform that termination for her. Mm-hmm. That would be an example of an indirect femicide.
Okay.
So in some countries, violence against women still appears to be tolerated to some extent. I mean, where are we here in the Bahamas on that? I mean, do we still, you feel there is a tolerance for that? Because that seems to be the cause for it, right?
Definitely. Definitely there's still tolerance. If there wasn't tolerance, then we would see intervention. You know, we would not be seeing the killings that we see now or the extent of violence that we're seeing now. I had some interesting conversations last week. We were having focus groups and I was working with some colleagues from Global Rights for Women. And one of the colleagues, Melissa Skaya, actually works with perpetrators. So she is one of the leaders of a group for male perpetrators of violence, in particular domestic violence, intimate partner violence. And she said that they've learned that shame does not work. You know, just shaming a person for their violence does not actually work. But what does work is consequences. And those consequences have to come from every aspect of society, every aspect of their lives. So it's not just consequences that are legal or part of our so-called justice system, but also family members saying, oh no, that's not acceptable. And if you don't change your behavior, you're not welcome here. We're not going to allow that. And every time you come around, we're going to talk about it. So, it also means the church saying, you're a member here, you're showing up every Sunday, but we have to check you on this behavior. It has to change. And here are some ways that you can change it. Here are some resources and services that are available to you. It's also your workplace saying, oh no, you cannot work here and be wearing this uniform and treat your wife or treat your girlfriend that way. That is not acceptable. So consequences have to come from all of these different pockets of a person's life.
You know, I want to say we're in the Junkanoo season, right? And wouldn't it be great if Junkanoo community, right? Like if we could pull the Junkanoo community in as well to say, hey, listen, boy, you can't be in this Junkanoo group if you insist on this behavior. If you refuse to get help or get counseling. And I say, I'll say the same thing for female perpetrators of violence, right? Like, look, you can't be a part of this group if you think we can just let you abuse your partner, you know, and then come run here. Because junk canoe groups, I mean, to be a part of a junk group is a thing of pride, right? It's a thing of status.
Absolutely.
And it would be great if junk canoe groups said, listen, we take our location, our space in society seriously. And not only are we not going to tolerate this behavior, but we're going to commit to supporting our members and supporting their needs, right? Like, hey, if I, a junk canoe group, is taking a man or a woman out of their household for 6 months out of the year, for 3 months straight, then surely that family is a part of our family, and we have to extend ourselves, you know, to support them in the same way that they're supporting the group.
I mean, it just seems to me that we're always putting a Band-Aid on this, you know, because one of the ways you look at it is, okay, we offer services to women, access to different services, you know, but that's usually after it's happened.
Yeah.
So what Alicia's saying about the consequences is important. How do we get at the front end, you know, and stop that kind of behavior and make it, and have we got that level of consciousness? I mean, we're supposed to be a Christian nation, right? This is supposed to be something that we are should be totally against, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so how do we create that changing consciousness that somebody will just stop themselves, right?
Right.
And say, I'm not going to do that. Or
how do we make the connections, Ms. Wallace? Like what Mark is saying, there is a place of sort of self-motivation, right? Mm-hmm. Where somebody says, I wouldn't let nobody beat up on my mommy. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't let nobody beat up on my daughter, right? Mm-hmm. How do we take that energy or that sort of consciousness and extend it? So somebody says, I wouldn't let nobody beat up on my mommy. Why am I gonna beat up on this woman? Let me do something different, you know?
Yeah, and I think, you know, a lot of times when we talk about violence against women and we're trying to sort of convince people not to be violent, we go to that. What about your mother? What about your sister? What about your daughter? And that line of argument and line of thinking is actually a big part of the problem.
Okay.
Because people are really able to justify their actions. I'm doing this because, and they will even tell the person that they're abusing, you caused this. This is why this is happening. This action that I'm taking, this violent action, is appropriate because X, Y, Z. But they're not using their reasoning when it comes to the women or the girls that belong to them. Mm-hmm. And so that's a part of patriarchy, right? This idea that men have to protect women and girls. That's their job. Men and boys, they're supposed to be protectors, but really they're supposed to be protecting women and girls from what? From other men and boys. So if you don't have a relationship to a man or a boy who is able to protect you, then you are without protection. And you know, somehow that's your own fault. So this ownership is transferred from a father or another person who is a father figure onto the groom.
Mm-hmm.
Like we actually have it in the wedding ceremony that now it's your job. Now you take care of this person. Now you protect her. Now you own her and you get to make decisions about her. So we actually need to step away from that. We need to come out of that way of thinking, because it leaves us in this place where there are some women who are just not protected, but also we're continuing this idea that women and girls need protection rather than changing the world so that it's not a place where we need to be protected. It's a place that we are inherently safe.
All right. Now, that's an excellent point. But let's stick a pin right there, because I think that the government does have an obligation to protect women and girls and boys and children, right? I would hate for state actors and a sort of a political culture, I would hate for them to suggest that, well, no, the government can't. It ain't our job to protect women and girls. If you're saying that they're not objects, and why does the government have an obligation to end femicide, or why does a state actor have an obligation, right, to protect women and girls, or why do they have an obligation to create an environment where they are safer?
we've already created this environment where we're not safe. You know, where women and girls, if you ask their number one fear, rape is probably going to be it. You know, there are other forms of violence that figure in there, but usually the greatest fear is being raped. And that's because that we've designed the world in this way. We've designed even the Bahamas, we've designed various islands in this way that we require protection. And if we move without that protection, the blame is put on us, right? So we have to change the way that we operate. We have to change the way that society operates so that we get to that place where protection isn't required. But until we get there, the government does have obligations and it knows that. There's really no basis for an argument that the government is not responsible for the safety and the protection and realization of the rights of women and of children. And we know that because it being the state, the government representatives, travel the world, they go to international spaces, and they confirm their obligations by ratifying and adopting various conventions and declarations. So we can look at the Convention on the Rights of a Child, which has been ratified, though the Bahamas has yet to report on its movement toward coming into full compliance. It has ratified the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women, which we know as CEDAW, or the Bill of Women's Rights in 1993. We're coming up on the 30th anniversary. We're still not in full compliance. We still have two reservations on Article 2A, which is integral to the convention. It's really about discrimination itself and what discrimination is and the government's obligation to remove any discrimination from its law. And the other reservation is on Article 9.2, which is on nationality. And we all know what is going on with the gender inequality in our nationality law, the quote-unquote failure of the 2016 referendum, and the promises that have been made by various administrations to make changes to our legislation to ensure that women are able to pass on citizenship at the very least to their children. And we have to understand that the government knows this. It's not arguing this in any spaces, except here, where it allows these issues, it allows the fact of human rights to be debated in the public space, in public discourse, and does not interrupt that debate by presenting facts. Human rights are real. Human rights are inherent. They're all dependent on each other. And as a government, as a democratic government, we are obligated to ensure that people are able to realize these rights. It's not that they don't exist. It's that we have not created the laws and the policies and the systems and made the resources and services available so that everyone is actually able to access those rights.
Absolutely. Have you seen this morning's Tribune?
Not yet.
Ah, boy, I should have just forwarded this one to you. Pinta, change laws and protect women. Ah, we got to go to a break. Thank you, producer. When we get back from the break, Alicia, in the break, I'm going to send you the link that I have. It's in today's Tribune. Pinta, change laws and protect women. Free National Movement leader said far too many women and girls are being abused in situations and that, quote, chauvinistic, close quotes, laws must be changed. We're going to talk about that when we get back from the break. Stay tuned, Alicia, please. To the audience, stay tuned to Guardian Radio 96.9 FM. We'll be right back.
how important collecting your money can be to the success of your business. Start your relationship with Fidelity today so that we can show you the many options available to you with our merchant services. From click and pay options online to merchant terminals and e-commerce options, we're here to help your business succeed. For more details, speak to one of our business development officers at 356-7764 in Nassau or 352-6676 in Freeport. Visit our website at fidelitygroup.com or visit any of our branches.
J.S. Johnson Insurance agents are the best. Reliable service, they've been on the scene, protecting since 1919. J.S. Johnson Insurance has the best. Always, you're always covering me. J.S. Johnson Insurance, peace of mind.
Love the show? Want to give your support? Become a sponsor today. Call 302-2300 for our rates and packages. That's 302-2300. Become a sponsor on Guardian Radio 96.9 FM. Fresh news, smart talk, all day.
This is Guardian Radio 96.9 FM, Nassau, Bahamas.
Morning this morning, my producer have the best dinner music. That's the music you eat your feelings to. Make your everything go down better. It's Junkanoo time. You can't deny that. What a wonderful time of the year. Let's get back into this conversation with Miss Alicia Wallace from Equality Bahamas during 16 days of activism. This year's campaign theme is Let's End Femicide. And I agree.
I mean, the question I have for Alicia, you know, the government has certain things that it's signed up to do, but they're kind of, I see them as being sort of behind the eight ball. What about being proactive, you know, doing something proactive? Because all these things cost money. You know, femicide costs money, recidivism costs money, social problems cost money, and it's actually an incentive for government to be proactive about this. What do you see their role beyond just, you know,
changing
laws.
Changing law is really important, but I'm always talking about the services and the programs and the resources that need to be made available. And I think one of the challenges that we have is that there are too few people, and there are too few people who are designing what should be interventions with too few experiences. So not really engaging the people who are having these real life experiences, people who are facing or who have faced these challenges, and recognizing that those are the people who actually have the solutions. We have these ideas that, you know, we need to go to the quote unquote experts. We need to find the people with the degrees, especially the masters. We need to go to the legislators. You know, it's always a lawyer who has all the answers. But it's the people who are in these situations, they know the barriers that they have faced. They know what made it difficult for them to get help. They know how unhelpful some of these systems are and some of the services that we think are fantastic. They know where there is lack. And so that's where we need to start. Start with those people and not tokenizing them and not having them be representatives of entire communities, but truly engaging with people to find out what is needed and how we can build it together, and how they can be compensated as well for their expertise, which may not come in the form that people expect, like a piece of paper that's framed and on a wall, but a kind of expertise that comes from immersion and real life experience. If we start there, I think we would get a lot further ahead And, you know, of course, changing the laws, this is really important. The law is what shapes everything else, laws and policies. And signing on to these international conventions is also incredibly important because it gives us a tool that can measure what is happening. We can monitor, and then we have a place where we can report, a place that should be unbiased, because they have committee members from all over the world, different perspectives, different experiences themselves, where we can say, look, this is what was committed to, yes, but here's what's actually happening on the ground. And our reports can be taken as NGOs, as members of civil society, and weighed alongside the reports that the state makes for itself. And then these committees, these experts, can make recommendations to help the government to move forward. And then we can then use those recommendations on the ground to advocate for the other things that we need. So that's one of the things that we do at Equality Bahamas. We had 6 demands during the 16 days campaign last year. Mm-hmm. And we've continued with 5 of those demands this year. The good news is one of those demands was met last week when the Bahamas ratified Convention C-190, ILO's C-190, which is the Convention for the Elimination of Violence and Harassment in the World of Work. So that's quite a big win for that for over a year. It's now been ratified. That's great. But we recognize that that is not the end. It's really just another beginning, because now we have to advocate for that to be implemented. We have to push for employers to be educated on what C-190 is and what that's going to mean for them in real life.
Can we talk about that for a moment? And also, I want to ask, I didn't ask last night, do you have any stats on femicide over the last few years? Or if I could rephrase the question, are there any documented statistics on femicide, like official statistics on femicide from the government or from any intra-governmental organizations that we're working with?
So we don't have those statistics from the government. You may recall earlier this year that someone from the Royal Bahamas Police Force actually said that we don't have femicide here, and then went on to say that when women are killed, it's usually a result of domestic violence. So that tells you that there's a really big disconnect. Yeah. There's a complete lack of understanding of gender-based violence. There's a complete lack of femicide and what it is. Mm-hmm. And because of that, we do not have proper recording. Mm-hmm. We do not have proper reporting on femicide. As far as the statistics over the last few years, that is one of our initiatives this year during the 16 days campaign. We have lots of public events like we usually have, but we also have some private events where our team and members of our community that have consistently been showing up to our events, we're working to develop a femicide observatory. So we're looking at ways that we can actually collect this data since it's not reported as femicide, but mm-hmm. there are ways that we can look at what is reported to determine which of these murders, which of these killings are results of gender-based or sex-based violence. And actually this evening, we will be in conversation with Myrna Dawson, who is the director of the Canadian Femicide Observatory for Justice and Accountability. And that is housed at the University of Guelph in Ontario. Mm-hmm. And we're really excited to talk with her about what that looks like. How does it run, Femicide Observatory? What kind of data do they collect? What other kinds of research do they do? And then how do they use that to intervene and to prevent gender-based violence and ultimately femicide? And we're having this conversation as a learning opportunity and to help us to figure out how we as a civil society organization can develop a femicide observatory in the absence of our government and law enforcement doing what they need to do.
So stats, I mean, stats are always important, right? Because I was looking, I did a little research. Apparently Honduras has the highest rate of femicide. I think it's 4.2 cases out of 100,000 women. Now, if we assume we got 200,000 women or girls, women in the Bahamas, do you, just top of the hat, do you think we have more than 8 cases a year?
I think so, yes.
Wow.
I do think we have more. And, you know, in Latin America, they are in many ways far ahead of us, not just in the Bahamas, but in the Caribbean in general. But they have been using the word femicide and in some cases feminicide to describe these gender-based and sex-based killings of women and girls for a long time. And they are properly counting and recording, particularly in Mexico, they're doing a really great job. Last year, we had a fantastic conversation with a number of activists from different parts of the world. That conversation, that event was called Femicide Around the World. And the recording can be found on our YouTube channel, which you can access at Equality242. And we had someone from Mexico talking about the situation there and the work that they're doing and the importance of mapping. So they're doing region-wide in Latin America mapping of femicide so they can see where it is happening, who it's affecting. And some of the value in doing that kind of work is that you're able to identify risk factors. When you identify risk factors, it gives you a place to start your prevention and your intervention work.
Absolutely. This is good. This is good stuff. Can we circle back to ILO for a second? ILO, that's the International Labor Organization, C-190, ratified. What is the implication? Like, what does this mean for the government and the public service, for private sector employers and employees, and for the labor movement?
This means it's being recognized that violence and harassment do take place at work. Mm-hmm. And these are not private issues. These are not issues that we can separate out. You know, sometimes we like to say, oh no, that's not for this. That needs to be handled over there. That's work for this organization to do.
Yeah.
But what C-190 does, and what we found really interesting about it at Equality Bahamas, is that it defines the world of work in a very broad way. So it says that the world of work is not limited to your office or your cubicle. It's not even limited to the building or to the property. It includes transportation. Mm-hmm. So how you get to and from work. It includes accommodations. You know, there are a lot of people who have to travel for work.
Mm-hmm.
And so for them, it includes where they stay. It includes any kind of changing rooms, where they have to use the restroom, trainings, and any other events or social activities that they have to participate in as a part of their work. And importantly, it includes work-related communications.
Mm-hmm.
So we're also looking at communication technologies. And by extension, we have to look at the behaviors of people at work. So last year, we focused on domestic violence at work to remind people that domestic violence doesn't stay at home. In many cases, the perpetrator knows that they can find the victim at work. It's a reliable place to find a person. And living in a small place and even working within small to medium-sized businesses, you kind of get to know each other. You get to know who picks this person up, you know, who's married, who has children. And you can become a little bit free with information. Mm-hmm. You know, so somebody calls in and you say, Bianca, no, she didn't come into work today. She off. And you think that's fine because this is Bianca's boyfriend or her husband that you're talking to, but you don't know what is going on.
Yeah.
So this ratification of this convention is going to push employers to properly train employees and to take confidentiality more seriously, to understand the different forms harassment takes and seeing that it's not always completely visible to you,
mm-hmm.
And to increase the protection of employees. We heard the story, I think it was maybe 2 years ago, that a woman who works on the radio was being stalked by a listener. And this person was commenting on her live streams over and over again. And it just got worse and worse and worse until he started showing up at her workplace, hanging around the parking lot, asking people which car was hers.
Yeah.
And so she ended up having to get men at work to walk her to her car. She was afraid to drive straight home from work. So in this case, what is the responsibility of the employer, especially since she is a public figure, she's on the radio, she's being shown in this live stream. These comments are being made in the live stream. Who is monitoring that?
Right.
Who's paying attention to that?
And how
can we ensure the protection?
And in the particular dynamic here, where many security officers who are posted to establishments are not employees of the establishment, right? Like they're subcontractors, and a lot of work to take place in that space. Who is responsible, right? I'm tired of looking at security officers, watching people blatantly break rules on the establishment. And then you look at the security officer like, buddy, do you not understand why you are posted here? Like you don't get that your job is to tell the people they can't do that. This is great, and I hope that these. So who then tells the government? Who then tells employers? Like, look, this is what your new role is.
Because remember, back in COVID, we quickly learned out what we had to do, right?
Everyone,
because there were public announcements on social distancing, all those things. So every employer, it was actually quite straightforward. We didn't have to dig very hard and to find out what we needed to do. It could be simply as simple as that, couldn't it? Just the government, notice, a continuous notice explaining, six or eight things or whatever it is the training requires. Eventually we'll get it and put signs. Maybe signs in the workplace say this is a safe, a safe environment for women or something like that.
Absolutely. Yeah. Ms. Wallace, I got two texts here. It wouldn't be an Equality Bahamas show if we didn't have a couple of hot texts. So I'm going to read these two texts. Okay. The first one is, everything she's talking about needs to be offered to same-sex people. Offer them counsel because that's a state of mental sickness, God knows. That's ungodly. Dear texter, you're absolutely right. Protections, LGBTI people deserve protections in the workplace. They deserve protections from gender-based violence. Not because it's ungodly, but because they're humans too. A second text. What about the harassment of younger females in the professional ranks? When the harassment comes from older professional women who may feel threatened. Now, okay, dear texter, I like that. I thought he's going somewhere else because I'm also going to ask specifically sexual harassment.
Yes.
Not just from men, but from women. And I'm going to make this point because my texters feel like I don't know. We do know. We do know that we've had some predatory women. In fact, we do know it seems like there's a culture similar to the culture of predatory men. Right? Let's not act like it's something on its own. But we're going to acknowledge that. And we've seen that not just in professional spaces, but we've seen it in the sporting world as well, right? And so, have you found any literature? Like, are there any countries that are openly, that are not just focusing like on men harassing women, but are saying, listen, we acknowledging that we get same-sex harassment as well. Are there any countries out there? Are there any models we could look to bring models home?
There are some countries that are moving toward more gender-neutral language.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the most recent is St. Lucia's Domestic Violence Act,
okay,
which is very intentionally gender-neutral to ensure that it covers same-gender couples,
mm-hmm.
People who are LGBTQI+. And that's a start.
Yeah.
Sexual harassment, I have to look back at our laws to see, but I think that it's specific to the positions of the people, so employer versus employee.
Yeah.
And a lot of sexual harassment law is about sort of top down.
Yeah.
There are a few that look at employee to employee as well.
Okay.
But certainly this is not something that should be, there should not be a distinction between genders because sexual harassment is sexual harassment.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Even though we may see a preponderance, right, of male harassment towards female staff or underlings, we do know that it happens disproportionately. Listen, I think our producer's telling us that we're all out of time. It's time for Guardian Radio AM to rush in to the studio. Ms. Wallace, I'd like to thank you very much. To people who were attempting to call the show this morning, we're working on it. Just keep calling. I bet you by next show they'll have it all sorted out. Anyway, you guys stay tuned to Guardian Radio. Ms. Wallace, thank you very much. And we're going to have you on again before the end of the year so we could continue talking about...
Thank you, Aaron. Thank you, Mark.
Yeah, take care.
Absolutely. Remember, Human Rights Defender Day is the 9th of December, and the 10th of December is Human Rights Day. You guys have a wonderful, wonderful day. We'll see you tomorrow.